You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
Vanished is mixed in stereo surround sound and is best experienced using headphones. If you have a set of headphones or earbuds, put them in now. This program is a theoretical account of the events of November the 24th, 1971, and thereafter. Although the FBI officially closed their case in 2016, the outside investigation into the identity of the man known as D.B. Cooper remains unsolved. Vanished is recorded in its entirety with the Zoom H1N microphone. Get yours now at zoom-na.com. Welcome back. Anniversaries are fun, and if you followed this show, you know that we kind of make a big deal of those around here. January 5th, 1939. After vanishing over the Pacific Ocean alongside her navigator Fred Noonan, icon Amelia Earhart is declared dead in absentia. August 31st, 1888. The body of Mary Ann Nichols was discovered at 3:40 a.m. in Whitechapel, officially beginning Jack the Ripper's Autumn of Terror. April 14th, 1865. President Abraham Lincoln is assassinated by John Wilkes Booth, leading to a nationwide manhunt just after the end of the Civil War. Remembrance of those days is important because they tell stories. Stories that have been expanded upon and investigated thoroughly to this day. And that brings us to tonight. Not too many people can become historically associated with the verb, but our next subject can. 50 years ago tonight, a still unidentified man skyjacks a commercial airliner and demands a $200,000 ransom, which is a little over $1.3 million today. He jumps out of that airliner into the darkness, never to be seen again. He has no ending and no beginning. He exists for only a few short hours, and in that time, he commits the perfect crime. His name is only an alias, but it's become the most famous alias in all of aviation history. Tonight, we have a first for this show as we release our entire series on one very special anniversary. 50 years ago, an unassuming man jumps into history. He's become a ghost. But now, perhaps finally, we'll have a name to go with that ghost. Oh, you thought we were done? We're just getting started. Welcome back to Vanished, in part one of our three-part series on the man known as D.B. Cooper.
When he got on a plane in Portland, Oregon last night, he was just another passenger who gave his name as D.A. Cooper.
It's one of the most notorious unsolved crimes in U.S. history, the 1971 D.B. Cooper hijacking.
36 passengers got off the jetliner in Seattle last night, left aboard four crew members and the hijacker, dressed in a business suit demanding $200,000.
You saw the exchange of money?
We saw them bring the money aboard.
Despite the FBI's pursuing thousands of leads and nearly as many suspects, the hijackers' true identity was never uncovered.
He was not nervous. He seemed rather nice.
I think of him as being just another sleazy, rotten criminal.
The FBI officially ending what it called one of its longest and most exhaustive investigations.
Hey, Chris, just checking in. It looks like you're going to have to do this one on your own. As much fun as it would be, I have more pressing issues in the Southwest region than D.B. Cooper at the moment. Let me know if you uncover anything. We'll talk soon.
Southwest region. Well, at any rate, it looks like you're stuck with me for this one. So let's get into it. I've been out of the game for a long time. We haven't recorded in the better part of a year, but Cooper's been looming. With the 50th anniversary upon us, I figured I better warm up. The best way to put a series like this together is to start talking. Begin that discussion. And of course, I have plenty of friends I can call on to give me their perspectives on what I'm about to do. When you and Nikki were running Color Me Dead, you focused very heavily on sort of the true crime genre, and you covered some really horrendous, hard to cover cases.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I got a little sample of that when we covered Ripper for this show last Halloween. So in essence, D.B. Cooper fits your MO simply by this story being a true crime story. What have you heard about this case? When do you first remember hearing about Cooper?
When I was a young lady in my early 20s, I spent a lot of time at the clubs and going to raves. And there was a place called D.B. Cooper's. It was a bar, and the basement was you know, subleased for the private events. And I had asked somebody, I was like, oh, is DB Cooper, like, is he the owner? And they laughed and they were like, you don't know who that is? I'm like, nah.
Yeah.
And so they kind of gave me the Cliff's Notes version. Oh, like he was this really famous robber. He like pulled this crazy heist, got all this money, and then leapt out of a plane. And he and his fortune were never found. I was like, oh, okay. Now I actually got to find out, like, what did this guy do and how much money did he really get?
Right.
I just hopped online. I looked up at Wikipedia. And so I just only have kind of a basic knowledge.
Angel Mays was one half of the very popular Color Me Dead podcast. Her and her co-host Nikki immersed themselves in true crime, covering some of the most horrific cases you'll ever hear. While Cooper is out of the league of people they investigated, Angel always has a very straightforward approach to everything she looks at. That's what made her the perfect person to start this long walk with. Well, what I really want to ask you is the same question I asked Forrest Burgess from Astonishing Legends when he sat in with me during our Ripper series. And Cooper's a guy, he hijacks a plane, essentially putting the lives of, you know, dozens of people at risk. I think there were 36 passengers on the crew, or on the flight, plus the flight crew. Certainly the flight crew was at risk once the passengers were unloaded. I've been trying to figure out what his mindset must have been, because he's cool and calm the entire time. He even includes food for the crew as one of his demands. And a woman by the name of Tina Mucklow, who was a stewardess on the plane, who spent 4 or 5 hours with them, probably the most time with them, said he was never mean. He was never rude. In fact, he never said an unkind word to anyone. But at the same time, he's committing an act of air piracy. It's potentially a heinous act if things get really dark. What must the mindset be for someone like that, that can stay that calm and that cool and that collected in that situation, but potentially be doing something horrendous if things go south?
Which reminds me of a movie and also a case that Nikki and I covered. The film is 1975, came out Dog Day Afternoon.
Right.
That was based on a true story. Same thing. The guys went in. It was a difficult situation for them, and it was a crime that they committed, and it did go horrendously wrong, but it was desperation, something that he was doing out of love, but desperation, and kind of like a means to an end.
Right.
And was good and kind to the, you know, the employees in the bank. At one point in time, he had pizzas delivered for him. I don't think all crimes committed are committed by violent criminals.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're just desperate people at the end of their rope, and they're so desperate and they're so downtrodden and they feel hopeless and helpless that they're willing to do anything. Mm. And maybe that's where he was at.
Good point. Sort of piggybacking off of that, a guest and the advisor for this series, Darren Schaefer, who runs the Cooper Vortex podcast, he told me right now, as it stands, he's like 90% certain that the bomb Cooper had was not real. And that got me thinking, and I wanted to ask you this, does it add to maybe his intelligence level or his ability to keep a cool head that he could pull this off and the whole time knowing he's the only one that knows that there's, you know, likely no real threat if he's using a fake bomb? Does that change anything for you?
It does, because I think that they go in there with the mindset that they want no casualties. They don't want anybody hurt. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, they're not doing this because they're hateful, evil, violent, aggressive people, but because they're desperate. There are crimes that are committed where people will go in and try to rob a gas station by sticking what appears to be a weapon in their jacket, or even go so far as to use a replica pistol. You know, it's not loaded. It doesn't have a firing pin. It's not going to work, but it gives them the appearance of being in control. It gives them appearance of having the upper hand. I've got this weapon. I can hurt you really bad if I'd like to, but deep down, they don't want to do any of that.
Yeah.
But they need people to think it.
Yeah. And I think Darren mentioned that, you know, if someone had called that bluff, if there was an air marshal on board or something of that kind, they would have called his bluff and said, let me see the bomb. And it could have gone, and it wasn't a real bomb. It could have gone south really bad for him.
Right. In an instance where an air marshal is ultimately responsible for everybody on that plane, the likelihood of them being like, all right, well, you know what? I want to see that bomb and I want to shake it and check it. And I don't know that a responsible human being put in a position of authority, like an air marshal, would actually ask somebody and maybe like tempt fate with that many people on board.
It brings me to another question. There's a massive amount of DB Cooper in the pop culture sort of stratosphere. when it comes to this man and this crime in particular, it seems to be a mixed bag. You know, some people think he's a folk hero. Some people think he's a two-bit criminal that got lucky, and the rest are in the middle. Is it really surprising that someone like Cooper would sort of instantly become such a polarizing true crime figure like he has?
It doesn't surprise me. People sensationalize the strangest things, and people idolize even stranger things. The Kardashians are proof of that. It blows my mind. So when you see that somebody successfully, at the end of the day, successfully robbed, took a plane, I mean, he's kind of like a Robin Hood.
Yeah.
You know, I guess that's where people, you know, they look at this thing where, like, you know, he pulled it off.
Mm-hmm.
He got away with it.
Mm-hmm.
Stick it to the man, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, when I look at things like that, where he did manage to, you know, $200,000.
Yeah.
And he did get on that plane. And for all intents and purposes, he wasn't the bad guy on the plane. Mm-hmm. You know, he treated him with kindness. He fed him.
Yeah.
I think maybe that could have been another contributing factor. Maybe it would have been different if he got on the plane, pistol whipped a stewardess and sexually assaulted somebody. Then people are going to be like, that monster.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't.
There's only a handful of major cases that seem to hold the continuing attention of the whole world like this one does. You know, you show DB Cooper's the sketch to anybody and they're going to say, oh, DB Cooper, they're going to know who that is.
Right.
This one even has a term. It's called the Cooper Vortex. And it's really for people who are kind of sucked into this story and just can't get out. It's been 50 years tonight, and 50 years with no answers is a long time. Why do you think this case in particular continues to hold on after all this time?
So anytime that somebody doesn't have an ending to a story, they cling to it. It's kind of like the JonBenet Ramsey thing,
right,
where it's unsolved and there was no closure. There was no ending. And so people continue to salivate over it. They obsess, and it passes from one generation to the next. My son talked to me about true crime. I never got really deep into it with him because when I started, he was quite a bit younger.
Mm.
And then one time he asked me, do you know what the Zodiac is? And I was like, oh yeah, here we go again. You know, that was passed down from my mom, talked to me about that person. And then here I am talking to my boy about it.
Yeah.
And it's that there is no closure. There is no end, no nose. And it's that mysterious air that keeps people passing it along.
Yeah. And just passes down, just keeps going.
He's basically immortal now. Like, his name will never die.
You think we ever solve this? You think we ever have definitive closure, since you were just speaking about closure? Does it even matter 50 years later?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I think the only people that it matters to are the people that want to know what happened, but you got no criminal to prosecute and charge. Will they ever have closure to this? Not going to happen.
Mm.
There are a lot of unsolved crimes, whether they're heists, murders, you know, whatever, all over the world. Some that had way more evidence, way more witnesses. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they're still unsolved 20 years later. So the chances of this ever coming to an end, not going to happen.
Let's talk about DB Cooper, the man. What do we know about him? What kind of man was he? Was he skilled? Did he have a mindset that was just on a different level? Or maybe did he just have to get himself on Flight 305? Every heist contains one thing, a con. If Angel's Domain lies in the dark side of true crime, then I know just who to call to talk about the art of the con. I spoke with Angel Mays, who co-hosted Color Me Dead, and we spoke about the mindset of someone like Cooper within sort of the true crime spectrum. It's such a large spectrum. But I wanted to ask you one of the questions I asked her, but I want to put a little bit of a spin on it, because, you know, if Color Me Dead lives in the world of true crime, Pretend lives within the world of the con artist. So what must the mindset be for a man to be able to hijack a plane, take everyone on that plane hostage with 36 of them, I think, never even knowing they were in danger until after, and then continue to keep the flight crew hostage, all while keeping a level head? What kind of insight does that give us regarding maybe what kind of a man DB Cooper was?
Well, it takes a confident man, right?
Yeah.
That's where the word con man comes from, confidence man. You know, whoever DB Cooper was, let's say his name was Jack Smith or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't walk into that plane as Jack Smith. He walked in there. He didn't realize that he would be notorious for being DB Cooper, this mysterious man. But he walked in there playing a persona. And the persona happened to be a very undescript white guy, you know, maybe a businessman boarding a plane. And that was it. That was his deception. His deception was to blend in.
Yeah.
And the deception is important to note that the deception is actually a means to an end. Is that how you say it? A means to an end?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
It's not about the con. It's about the outcome, right? The con just gets you there. And mm-hmm. for him, the con was just getting in that plane, blending in.
Javier Leyva is the host of the incredible Pretend podcast. He lives in the world of the con artist. Javier has interviewed and covered almost every kind of mind in the game, including one listeners might know. Earlier this spring, he covered Martin McNally, a man that took inspiration from Cooper, hijacking an American Airlines aircraft headed to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and demanding $500,000. Similar to Cooper, he exited the aircraft mid-flight, diving to the ground below. And he almost dethroned him. So, I mean, having said that, piggybacking off that, in your opinion, was D.B. Cooper a con artist? Does he fit that mold from what we know?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we'll never know, right? Mm-hmm. But knowing that I've interviewed other con men that have done different things, you know, I would say, yeah, a con is a range of cons, right? Like you mm-hmm. have small little cons, like somebody robbing a convenience store, right? They somehow con you into thinking they're about to buy some gum, and then they rob you. Or you have the long con, you know, like the movies, like the ones that you see in the movies. I just saw a movie with The Rock, and you know,
yeah.
And it was this long, elaborate con that kept having twists and turns, and you never knew who was doing what. And I do think that D.B. Cooper was a con man in a sense that he approached the situation, he deceived people along the way, whether it were big or small, just to get what he wanted, which was the money.
Speaking of the money, it's a great segue. $200,000 in 1971, it's a lot of money, according to modern day inflation calculations. That's pushing about 1.5 million if the same heist were pulled tonight. We know only $5,800 roughly of it was recovered. Does it bother you that the rest has never been found? Like if we find out what happened to the rest of the money, but for whatever reason, it doesn't translate to a suspect reveal, does that tell us enough to give us an ending here?
See, I'm not a D.B. Cooper expert, but it does bother me, right? Like I know the story probably not as intimately as you, but it does bother me that only a little bit of the money was found.
Right.
Because that doesn't, you know, like that just makes it an even deeper mystery.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Martin McNally, he's a hijacker that I covered on Pretend. When he jumped off out of the plane with the money, I mean, he had it. He had never jumped out of a plane before, and he had the money in his hand. And somehow along the way, he dropped the suitcase with the money.
Man.
And that money landed in some farm, and it was recovered. That makes sense.
Right.
Right?
Sure. So
either he got away with it, or he didn't get away with it. Yeah. But the fact that there is only some of the money is just baffling.
Yeah, and none of it's turned up since then. You know, that's the crazy part of it is you know, we think with the circulation and as, you know, we have 50 years of technological leads on this money now, it's just gone. There's no...
And we know the flight path, right?
Right.
I mean,
we know almost everything we should know to be able to make some kind of a discovery here, some kind of a gain here in this case. But you just mentioned Martin McNally, and I listened to your series on him, The Hijacker, and you know, he pulled that heist partially based off of the success of D.B. Cooper, and he wasn't the only one. How big a role do you think the success of Cooper's hijacking plays in the copycat attempts that came shortly afterward?
Oh, it was everything. I mean, as you know, this was the golden age of hijacking and skyjacking. I mean, people, it was happening all the time, and people don't remember that because it's so rare mm-hmm. nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
But seeing this guy successfully, or what it appears to be successfully pulling this off, must have been really inspiring for all these other con men out there, all these other just guys that thought that they could get away with it too. And you have to put yourself in the mindset of these guys. It's like, you and I would never think that we could actually get away with this. But these guys have something in their mind, this crazy optimism, which I find with a lot of con artists,
yeah.
is that they think they can do it. You know, they're optimistic enough that they think they could pull it off. And that's a great quality to have.
Yes.
Except they do it for nefarious reasons.
Right, absolutely. Does it really surprise you that the inspiration, for lack of a better term, seems to continue to this day with this guy sort of, it's like a double-edged sword. This guy on one half is sort of like a modern day Robin Hood, if you want to go that route. And then there's other people that think he was just a two-bit scumbag, but there's an awful lot of people. There's celebrations. There was just a convention, CooperCon, the 50th anniversary in Portland, I believe it was, or Seattle, I'm not sure, where everybody sort of gathered to talk about this case. I mean, there's Cooper movies, there's comic books, there's certainly no shortage of books coming out. Does it surprise you that there's still this pop culture side of this case that this guy seems to sort of inspire, for lack of a better term, people to kind of either want to look into this thing more, or they want to celebrate it more, or whatever the case is?
No, it doesn't surprise me one bit, because if D.B. Cooper would have jumped out of that plane and go splat, we would know who D.B. Cooper was, right? If D.B. Cooper would have gotten arrested after this, we would know who he was, and there is no mystery.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we're talking about it today, mm-hmm. you know, so many decades after, is the fact that he's like that mask villain that we almost got a peek at the back, at his face, but we didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what captures our imagination. Look at Martin McNally,
mm-hmm.
okay? That guy successfully jumped out of a plane with the money. But nobody knows who Martin McNally is now, because there is no mystery. The fact that we don't know who D.B. Cooper is what captures our imagination, and we'll keep him infamous. I mean, that is what infamous means.
Mm-hmm.
We'll keep him infamous for the rest of time.
I love asking this question because everyone has a different reasoning to support their answers. But does this case ever get definitively solved in your mind? Do we ever know who this guy was?
You know, at this point, I don't want it to be solved.
Mm.
It's become part of our folklore, you know, in our country, that the victims were the airlines. None of the passengers got hurt. This guy is a historical figure now that we look back and we romanticize these crimes, which, it could be problematic. But if we solve it, then it takes away all the fun. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I think that, not that what he did, I want to encourage people to do, but
right.
he has inspired so many people to do that convention, to do films, to, you know what I mean? Like, it's part of our, and we're so far removed from it now that it's part of our folklore.
Mm-hmm.
And part of me doesn't want it to be solved.
Tell me about Bryant Coffle, because you mentioned this when we were talking offline. And he was one of the suspects. He's probably not a suspect that a lot of people know of. So for our audience, this will be good. Tell me a little bit about him and why he sticks out, or why you wanted to talk about him.
Yeah, you were asking me about, you know, if D.B. Cooper was a con man. And, well, we don't really have a definitive way of knowing that. But chances are he may have been. And one of the primary suspects, his name was Bryant Coffle,
mm-hmm.
was a longtime criminal, and he was a con man and took a lot of pride in his crimes. And after the hijacking, he went around claiming that he was D.B. Cooper. And many people took him seriously. In fact, he physically matched the description.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it got a lot of people wondering. But over the years, it was debunked. Like he just didn't have some of the information that he had did not match some of the undisclosed information that the FBI had.
Mm-hmm.
So after a while, they didn't consider him a suspect anymore. But it makes you wonder, you know, if we're talking about con men, I think all these people are cut from the same cloth. You know,
yeah.
If Bryant Coffle was a con man, I wouldn't put it past the real D.B. Cooper being a con man too.
After talking with Angel and Javier, I'm feeling a little better. D.B. Cooper is a mountain. 50 years old tonight, this case has been at the forefront of historical mystery since the night he vanished into the darkness. In order to navigate that darkness, we need a guide. Someone that knows this case, but has an open mindset to have conversation with someone like me. Well, as my luck, and your luck for that matter, would have it, we've all been listening to the man that will be our guide for a long time. And we're all lucky to have him. For the people listening that maybe just have a passing knowledge in this case, or just know the name D.B. Cooper, tell us the story as we know it for the afternoon evening of November 24th, 1971.
A middle-aged dude in a business suit and overcoat, possibly trench coat, walks into the Portland International Airport. He buys a one-way ticket to Seattle. The ticket costs $20, including tax. the only information that is required, the only identification required to fly. The gate agent asks, "What is your name?" This gentleman responds,
"Dan Cooper."
The gate agent writes Dan Cooper on the ticket. He boards the plane to Seattle. He's one of the last to board, sits in the back of the plane. Right before takeoff, he hands a stewardess a note. The stewardess, Florence Schaffner, assumes it's just another middle-aged dude just trying to hit on her. So she puts the note in her purse, does not look at it. He notices this a minute or two later.
"Miss, you'd better have a look at that note. I have a bomb."
He gives his ransom note at this point. He wants $200,000 and 4 parachutes ready to go on the ground in Seattle before they land. He wants to land on sort of an isolated, poorly lit runway. They land in Seattle. He lets the passengers off the plane once he gets his money. The passengers did not know they were being hijacked. It's about a 45-minute flight. They ended up being in the air for about 2.5 hours. But I think that is important for people to know. The passengers did not know the plane was being hijacked. He just slid notes between the stewardess to the flight crew, and they radioed in his demands. Once they are on the ground in Seattle, he has some very specific flight instructions at this point. He wants the plane to fly to Mexico City at 200 miles an hour. He wants the plane to fly at 10,000 feet with the flap set to 15 degrees, the landing gear down, and the cabin to remain depressurized. And he wants to take off with the rear stairs down. Now, he hijacked a Boeing 727, which famously has those rear aft stairs that lower. So when you fly into small airports and whatnot, if they don't have shuttle trucks, back in the old days. And they're freaking out now. So the pilots aren't even sure if the plane can fly with the stairs down, nevertheless take off with them down. And also with his demands, they don't have enough fuel to make it to Mexico City. So the pilots call in to air traffic control in Seattle. Can this plane fly with the rear stairs down? They don't know. So they have to call Boeing. Boeing says, yes, actually, this plane can fly with the rear stairs down. We've done testing on this. It is possible. The pilot still refuses to take off with the rear stairs down. Cooper says, I'm not going to argue with you about this. I'll just lower them when we get in the air. They take off. All the passengers are gone. He keeps one stewardess on the plane in case he needs help. Her name's Tina Mucklow. And then you have the rest of the flight crew. They agree to refuel in Reno, Nevada. The plane takes off somewhere between 8:11 and 8:13, depending on the transcript you read. They feel a pressure bump in the cockpit. That's when they believe Cooper jumped out of the airplane. They ended up using the exact same plane, flew it out over the Pacific Ocean at the same altitude, at the same speed, and pushed a 200-pound weight off. And it duplicated that pressure bump that they experienced. So that's how they theorized Cooper jumped out of the plane at that time, which would put him over Ariel, Amboy, Yakult in the Pacific Northwest. No one has seen or heard from Dan D.B. Cooper since then.
If you've been following D.B. Cooper even remotely, then you know the Cooper Vortex podcast. It's not only a description for the case, it's also become the podcast of record on D.B. Cooper. Darren Schaefer is the captain of that ship, and he's a damn good one. I reached out to Darren almost immediately when we decided to do this, and I'm happy to say he's become a friend. For someone like me, navigating this case would be impossible without him. We're kindred spirits, Darren and I, myself with Amelia Earhart, and he with D.B. Cooper, arguably the two biggest aviation cases of all time. And he's agreed to advise on our series, as well as guest.
Okay, there's lots to unpack there, so there's a few things I want to talk about when it comes to this. The one thing I want to ask you, in all that you know and everything you've covered on this case, the instructions that he gives, you talk about him having very specific flight instructions. What does that tell you about who this guy possibly was? I mean, we'll get into that a little more in detail in a bit, but just in general, is this somebody that knows more than the average person when it comes to this particular aircraft?
More than the average person, he knows more about the plane than the pilots.
Right.
There shouldn't be a time where you know more about the plane than the pilot. It says so much what he knows about this plane. The fact that when the pilot refused to take off with the rear stairs down, and he really does say, I'm not going to argue with you about this. Fine, I'll lower him in the air. To me, that says something like that he has experience that this is cool.
Yeah.
That there's no problem in doing this. The flaps set to 15 degrees. That's not something the average person would say. It's also one of the actual indentations in the flap setting for the Boeing 727. That's almost like pilot jargon. Mm-hmm. You're going to set the flaps to this on this specific plane. He knows more about the plane than the average person. And that says a lot.
Yeah.
It wasn't a plane that people thought could be jumped even. There were thoughts you can't jump out of a jet.
Mm.
You just can't do it.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned earlier, he approaches the counter. He buys a ticket. This is 1971. You know, this isn't obviously modern day. If Cooper would have been asked to run his briefcase through a metal detector, story over. We're having a very different conversation right now, right?
It'd be an awkward moment for him.
Yeah, it really would. What I want to ask you about is Cooper's plane ticket. You alluded to it earlier. What do we know about the person he approached first at the ticket counter? Who were they? Were they ever interviewed by the FBI? And do we know much about that part of the story other than just kind of what you alluded to earlier?
We know basically everything about that story. I'm embarrassed by your awesome question because I don't remember the ticket agent's name exactly. But he was definitely interviewed by the FBI. The story played out, you know, just like I said. He didn't find the guy suspicious in any way.
Yeah.
He just assumed it's just another business traveler. His name was Dan Cooper. Mm-hmm. I wrote Dan Cooper on the ticket, and then the next person in line came.
Yeah, and it's a pretty well-known sort of aspect of the case of, you know, how the name DB came about. And of course, I'll ask you that in a moment, but let's talk about how the name Dan Cooper came about. Why do you think you chose Dan? Was it just a random name you think it popped into his head? Was there a method here?
Hell no, it's not a random name. Hell no. It's got to be based on the Dan Cooper comic book.
Talk about it.
There is a Franco-Belgian, which I think is like a fancy term for French or Canadian or German. It's also printed in Spanish. Comic about a Royal Canadian Air Force test pilot by the name of Dan Cooper.
Yeah.
Who did all of this bold stunt pilot stuff. There's one where he defuses a bomb in a commercial plane. There's another one where he's photographed jumping out of a commercial plane that's blowing up. There's a comic book called Dan Cooper where it pretty much does the same things that happened in the hijacking. And this comic book predates the hijacking. So Chris, if you're going to go rob a bank tomorrow, mm-hmm. and you're going to pick a random name, and you say, oh, I randomly landed on Tyler Durden. No, you did not randomly land on Tyler Durden. You picked that because of Fight Club. And so I have to believe that when he says, my name is Dan Cooper,
yeah,
that he's got to be holding back a smile. Because that's a joke that at that point in time, only he gets.
They fill out the ticket. He boards the flight. You ran us through the moments after Cooper boards the flight and kind of talked a little bit about what happened. Before his initial interactions with Florence Schaffner, is there anything else of note that occurs there? Like between the time he gets on the plane and he first interacts with Florence?
Really, no. Because he was so conspicuous. There wasn't any reason to notice this guy. So I believe there was testimony of one person at the airport who said basically, oh yeah, I remember seeing him sit over there.
Yeah.
I don't remember anything about him. I just remember him seeing him sit there. And he boards the plane, one of the last to board the plane, and sits in the back of the plane. Really, before he hands the note, there is no story.
It's interesting. Now, and as I just mentioned, obviously, and you talked about earlier, Florence Schaffner, the first person he interacts with sort of on the plane, he hands her the now infamous note you alluded to earlier. She ignores it. Cooper then says, Miss, you better look at that note. I have a bomb. When do you think it becomes real for her and the crew? It's instant, right? Like as soon as he says that?
Yeah, interestingly, it's sort of instant, especially for Florence Schaffner. So what I find interesting about this is she gets this ransom note, and this is, you know, part my educated opinion and part historical fact, but basically she is upset by it and is freaking out, understandably. And the other stewardess realizes, okay, Florence is struggling with this a little bit. I'm going to go handle the hijacker.
Yeah.
And that gal's name was Tina Mucklow, who ended up, she sat next to him for 5 hours and lit his cigarettes in the back of the plane. Because he hijacks the plane at like 2:50, jumps out at 8:11.
Yeah.
So he's got 5 hours with Tina Mucklow.
Is she on record talking about the entirety of that 5 hours?
Oh, yeah.
So there's nothing, you don't think there's anything that she would have ever left out or kept private or just never told anybody?
No. And I want to go into that a little bit. One of the things that frustrates me so much, and I'm sure you have the same pet peeve about the Earhart case, I always see people new to the case come up with these same two theories. One, Cooper did not jump out of the plane. He hid somehow in the plane or disguised himself as a pilot and then walked out.
Yeah.
It's just so not true. There's no evidence to support that at all. As a matter of fact, there's the opposite. There's evidence to support that that's never happened. They searched the plane with dogs. If there was spare room on an airplane, don't you think they would use it? They'd charge you to store more baggage there or something?
Yeah.
They're using every square inch of an airplane. There is no extra space anywhere. There is nowhere to hide.
Mm.
And certainly nowhere to hide from two or three dogs.
Yeah.
And a bunch of FBI agents.
Yeah.
On that plane. The second theory that really takes me off is that D.B. Cooper never existed.
Mm-hmm.
And the flight crew cooked it up and split the $200,000. First of all, these are people with good jobs who remained working for the airline after this happened.
Yeah.
How many commercial airline pilots in the last, let's say the last 50 years, have committed violent crimes?
Yeah.
I'm going to say it's pretty low, and the few that have are probably drug-fueled.
Yeah.
It's just not a group of people that commit bold crimes.
Yeah.
And there's, again, no evidence to support it. And the FBI definitely looked into the flight crew. They had no suspects. They looked into everyone. Bruce Smith reported speaking with Tina Mucklow's ex-husband, who said that he believed they were followed by the FBI for quite a while after the hijacking.
That leads me to another aspect then. So if that's the case, I want to talk about demeanor. From what little we know, you know, the crew statements, perhaps, you know, fellow passengers on that flight, what kind of guy was Cooper? What's his attitude? What's his approach to the overall situation? From what I've read and from what I've looked into, he seemed like a really cool cat.
Super cool. Calm, cool, and collected the entire time.
Yeah.
Immediately after the hijacking, Tina Mucklow says that he was polite, never rude, never unfriendly, and that at times became impatient, but was never hostile or anything to them.
Hmm.
As part of his demands, he asked for meals for the flight crew because he knew it would be a long time for them to go without lunch.
Hmm.
As a hijacker, that's a pretty considerate move.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're talking about, you know, Tina Mucklow's comments, this, you're talking about a 25-year-old girl who is talking about a guy who is threatening to blow her up in the air 27 minutes ago.
Yeah.
And she's describing him as friendly and polite.
You know, we talked earlier about him knowing more than the average person, knowing more than the pilots about the aircraft. And then you add the demeanor, the calm, the cool, the collected demeanor onto the plate. What does that further tell you about who this guy might have been? Someone who may have had thousands of jumps under his belt, potentially?
Yeah, I think more importantly than the jumps, I think it's operational experience.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to lean towards Cooper was military. I just don't think the average guy in that scenario, this is a very bold crime.
Yes.
Very bold. It's essentially the first to be pulled off like this. It's the first to be pulled off like this, arguably the first to be attempted like this. And he never seems to be worried. And I gotta think that's a guy who has seen shit before. This is not my first rodeo, And also maybe the fact that, you know, no one's got a gun in his face. This is a pretty easy operation for him.
Yeah.
So that can help explain why the calm, cool demeanor. The airline was giving Cooper whatever he wanted.
Yeah.
They wanted to comply with everything. So the flight crew was definitely like, whatever you want, dude, 100%. Because they cared about the plane and the crew.
Yeah.
The passengers are already gone. They still very much care about the crew. They very much care about the plane because it cost way more than $200,000.
Yeah. Speaking of interactions, there's a very brief but important line of communication between another flight attendant and Cooper that goes on at one point. She asks him if he has a grudge against the airline, and Cooper replies something to the tune of, I don't have a grudge against the airline, I just have a grudge. Now, that's a very, very loaded statement, but what do you think he means by that?
I'm not sure what he means by that. Who doesn't have a grudge?
Right.
It's tough to say if that's like a specific thing that he's saying, or if he's just an angry dude, or it was just his way of answering the question like that.
Yeah. Flight 305 remains, you know, as you mentioned, the only unsolved skyjacking in U.S. history. Several attempts made after Flight 305, copycats, people who think they can do it too. This is also another really loaded question, but why do you think Cooper, we talked about the demeanor and, you know, maybe his ability to have multiple jumps, thousands of jumps under him. Why do you think he was able to pull this off and everyone else has failed?
Well, that's not true at all. All of the other copycats survived.
Right.
They survived the jump. They may have been arrested, unlike Cooper.
Right.
But they survived the jump. And that says a lot, too, you know, to the fact whether or not Cooper survived the jump. You have six copycats, all of which survived the jump.
Yeah.
All the conditions are different, but, you know, arguably some conditions are worse in aspects of their jumps than Cooper's.
Yeah.
The others made the jump also. Why is Cooper the only one who is not caught? I don't know the answer to that. I've heard people say that Richard McCoy would not have been caught had it not have been for the fact that one of his buddies turned him in.
Yeah.
But you can't say stuff like that because once he's caught, people stop looking.
Yeah.
So you don't know the answer to that. Why he's not caught, I think it's because he kept his mouth shut.
Yeah.
I really do.
Regarding the Boeing, we talked a little bit about the stairs earlier. I mean, again, we've alluded back to the idea that this guy had, you know, more knowledge about this particular aircraft. There's certain suspects, we won't go into specific names, but there's certain suspects that maybe might have had an intimate knowledge of the Boeing 727. I mean, do you think you can go so far as to say that, or do you think that this guy just maybe had a really fantastic general knowledge of aircraft at the time?
Well, it's interesting because he had a fantastic knowledge, but then he needed the stewardess Tina Mucklow to show him how to lower the rear stairs.
Mm.
Also, when the rear stairs were lowered, according to the transcript, the plane was traveling too fast and he couldn't get them down.
Yeah.
So he went into the interphone, talked to the pilots. Hey, can't get the stairs down. They slowed down a little bit more and they lowered. So that's an interesting combination of knowledge in that knowing it could be done, but also not knowing how to get the rear stairs down. You know, it's kind of like, you know, race car driver can get the most out of a car, but he might not even know how many cylinders that car has.
Yeah.
Or how it works.
Yeah.
What type of brakes it has. It's an odd combination of knowledge, because if you look at someone like Kenny Christensen,
right,
a very popular suspect, he worked for the airline and flew in those planes. That dude would know how to lower the stairs.
Yeah.
Without question. But it would be surprising if he knew that that specific plane could be jumped.
Speaking about Christensen specifically, would he have had the ability to attempt to throw Mucklow off in his idea of, hey, can you help me lower these stairs? I don't know how to do it, when he really did. I mean, is that something that he might have used to maybe throw people off his scent potentially? Or is that just kind of going way out into the weeds, you think?
Theoretically, it's possible. It doesn't seem likely to me. Also, Kenny continued to work for that airline for years afterward. I have a gig where I don't see my coworkers a lot, but if I committed a heinous crime against my company, I would still be real nervous seeing my coworkers.
Yeah.
When there was a police sketch of me.
Yeah.
That my company was very concerned about.
You know, you talked about leaning towards the idea that maybe Cooper was military at some point in his life, either, you know, right up to that point or, you know, prior in another life or whatever the case is. You know, you've done so much work on, you know, in general, you've spoken with so many experts on this. Is Cooper's, other than the idea that he was military, because, you know, that's an obvious skill set, and that would obviously qualify somebody to do a jump of this magnitude. Is his background just really a crapshoot based off of everything we know right now? Like, he could have certainly been military, and it leans that way, but he could have just been a professional jumper of some kind. I mean, we really don't know what we don't know here.
He could have been transgender. He could have been a zookeeper. He could have been one of Nixon's plumbers.
Yeah.
I mean, really, Chris, there is zero backstory to Dan Cooper, D.B. Cooper, and zero story after. The only thing we have to sort of guess is the particles found on the tie.
Well, and that's a great segue. Cooper's tie was a large part of the very recent History's Greatest Mysteries piece. What do you make of the tie? I mean, what that piece of evidence could potentially do or has already done for this case?
Well, the tie's, I guess, one of two pieces of evidence in this case, really. You have the only thing left on the plane when it lands in Reno is a black clip-on tie. And then, like I'm sure we'll talk about later, you have the $5,800 found on Tina Bar in 1980.
Yeah.
Plane lands in Reno. The only thing Cooper left behind is a black clip-on tie. He asked for his ransom notes back and his communication notes with the pilot back. He jumped with those. He had a briefcase bomb. He jumped with that. Many people have said Cooper had with him either like a brown paper sack or a canvas bag. That's been speculated. Eyewitnesses have said that, but there's no evidence to support it. If he had that with him, he jumped with that also.
Yeah.
So the black clip-on tie gets analyzed for evidence. Ooh, I want to say it's like 2010-ish by Tom Kay and the Citizen Sleuths.
Yeah.
And they find a bunch of weird stuff on this tie. It's a cheap JCPenney tie from like 66 or something like that. And they find rare earth minerals on it that would only have been used in like CRT tubes and some radar applications. There was pure titanium on the tie, stainless steel on the tie, an odd combination of minerals and materials, things that wouldn't have been popular in 71.
Yeah.
Places where it should really narrow down where this tie came from,
yeah,
what kind of environment it would come from. But seemingly like everything else in the Cooper world, it really doesn't. I mean, if you could narrow it down based on the titanium or some of the rare earth minerals, it'll give you, let's say, 40 businesses in the United States.
Yeah.
Which you could narrow it down to 2,800 dudes. And probably 1,100 of those guys look like the sketch.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's a good point. Why would he have left the tie? Do we know why or why the tie was left behind?
I'm not sure why the tie was left behind. Who knows if it was intentional? Who knows if he actually forgot it? If you are jumping out of a plane, a tie would probably be pretty annoying. If it was a clip-on tie, then it would just kind of disappear.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why he left the tie. And also, was the tie secondhand is always a question. So even if we could find, without a doubt, this tie came from Bowling Green, Kentucky, 100% from this factory.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe he bought it secondhand.
Yeah, good point. Well, speaking of other items, and you just alluded to, a lot has been made about the contents of the briefcase, the attaché case. After all that's been said about it, what's your opinion on what was actually in the briefcase? Was it a live bomb?
I used to be 99% sure that it was a fake bomb. But this gal, Shayna Roth, wrote a great book about true crime and dedicated a chapter to D.B. Cooper. And she makes a really great point. What if you're called out on the bomb? So we know Cooper had a knife on him because he started cutting parachute cord and was seen doing that.
Yeah.
So he has a knife on him. But also, this is 71 and no security or anything. So I would guess out of the like 16 dudes on there, probably four of them had a knife on them.
Mm-hmm.
Just out of utility.
Yeah.
But if Cooper is called out on the bomb, I don't believe that's a bomb. You wouldn't blow yourself up on this plane.
Yeah.
And it's not. Then you're in a very awkward, very embarrassing position.
Yeah.
So that changes my mind a little bit. I know that's far-fetched, but let's say the stewardess comes up to the cockpit. She tells flight crew, hey, this guy in the back's got a bomb. I'm not expecting the stewardess to say, prove it.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say you get Captain America up in the cockpit. Bullshit. His guy doesn't have a bomb. And he goes back. Hey, I heard about this. Let me see it.
Yeah.
And if this guy knows anything and knows, hey, that's not a real bomb right away, then you're going to prison for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And in a very embarrassing way.
How good a look did Florence get at the bomb? Was it just a really quick peek? And was he taking a risk there? I mean, what if she knew about bombs? I mean, it's possible. I mean, what do we know about that?
What does the average 27-year-old woman know about bombs?
Good point. But you never know.
You never know, that's true.
Do you want to roll the dice?
But in 1971, I would be willing to roll those dice that the average 27-year-old woman doesn't know much about bombs.
All right, fair enough.
It is your stereotypical cartoon bomb. It is a bunch of red sticks and some wires, and he has a trigger or a remote that he has either pulled out of it or he's reaching into the case to hold, depending on what you read.
Yeah.
And I've also seen that one report, it looked like it was tape over the sticks, red tape over the sticks. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure if I can confirm that. The point is, if you're sitting next to someone on a plane and they say they have a bomb, you know what? I'm just going to believe that they're telling the truth. Let's do whatever you want.
Yeah, good point.
But I've changed from being 99% sure the bomb was fake to right now I would say I'm 90% sure the bomb was fake.
Well, moving on from the bomb, the idea, we talked about this earlier, and you know, the idea that he survived the jump or didn't is another highly contested aspect of the case. You mentioned the $5,800 found on Tina Bar. Let's discuss that. Other than the seemingly endless suspect list, what evidence is there that Cooper physically survived the jump?
That's a good question. Is there any evidence that he survived the jump? I would have to answer no. There is no evidence that he survived the jump. I'm also going to say there is no evidence that he didn't survive the jump.
Good point.
So, I mean, that's really where it is.
Yeah.
What I believe, in my opinion, points to him surviving the jump, most importantly, is Martin Andretti's work with surviving plane ejections. He compared World War II ejections over Europe and their survivability rate and found that there's like a 95% survivability rate and like a 97% if they pull their ripcord.
Yeah.
On top of that. And these were dudes who were bailing out in as bad or potentially way worse weather conditions.
Yeah.
Planes that were spiraling out of control. Planes that had parts blown off of them. Dudes that are injured. And their survivability rate is 95%.
Yeah.
And the odds that you pull your ripcord, the odds you're going to survive are insanely high. And the most of those guys that died after pulling the ripcord still had died from injuries suffered from the whatever happened in the air more so than the landing.
Yeah.
That points to D.B. Cooper surviving to me. You know, I would highly recommend everyone pick up Marty's book, Finding D.B. Cooper, Chasing the Last Lead, I believe is the title.
Yep.
If you have any doubt if he survived the jump or not, that's the first book I'm going to point you to.
Yeah.
The money pointing to whether or not he survived, I believe it does. I'll get to that in a second, but all of the other copycats, they survived their jump.
Right. Good point.
Conditions are different, but some had worse conditions here and better conditions there. They all survived their jump.
Mm-hmm.
And talking to parachutists, smoke jumpers, military, Navy SEALs, they all believe it's a survivable jump.
Yeah.
There's just so much to support that he survived the jump. And the money, if you want to say that supports him surviving the jump, the money's found in 1980. by an 8-year-old boy on a picnic with his family. He scoops some sand out of the way with his arm and stumbles across some garbage, picks it up and realizes, oh my gosh, it's not garbage. This is money. It's still packeted with the rubber bands on it. Once they're pulling it out of the sand, the rubber bands start to deteriorate. Tom K has recently discovered some diatoms on those bills that flower in the spring and summer exclusively. And what that says is that the money entered the water probably only about 8 or 9 months before it was found. Mm. And where it's found doesn't make any sense. It's not in the path of the plane. If you follow the waterways wouldn't have taken it there. So it's in a mysterious spot, in a mysterious place that no one can account for. But what we do know is that it didn't enter the water in the Columbia until a few months before it was found.
Yeah.
Does that say Cooper survived? No. Does it say he died? No. In my brain, it sort of works out that the money had to be somewhere for 8.5 years, right? Eight years.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't die in the jump. People talk about it being the most remote place ever and you die alone in the woods there. Or worst is when people talk about, what if you had to burn the money to survive out there?
Mm-hmm.
No, I grew up there. If I fell out of a helicopter into the woods somewhere and land perfectly safe in this scenario, of course.
Yeah.
And I don't know where I am. I know I don't have to walk very far until I can get to a river or a road in any direction.
Yeah.
And you're fine. There isn't anywhere in that flight path where it would be more than a few hours walk to something.
Yeah.
So I don't want to hear about him having to survive in the woods. That's bullshit.
Okay.
You got to get out of there. There is no camping in the woods out there.
Yeah.
And if he just augured into the ground and died, we would have found something. I mean, this is one of the most extensive manhunts in U.S. history, especially on U.S. soil. They searched for him with the SR-71 Blackbird back when it was like the most secret thing on the planet.
My favorite.
They searched for him with helicopters. They searched for him with planes. They searched for him with a submarine. When they figured out the drop zone, they had a group of 300 plus people just line up and stomp through the woods for a week or two.
Yeah.
And they didn't find anything. They found another dead body, but it wasn't D.B. Cooper.
And remind everybody that's listening to this or will be listening to this, what were the weather conditions the night of November 24th of 71?
It's overcast. It's the ground temperature, I want to say, was like 38 degrees. The temperature where he might have jumped be probably close to zero. It's raining. I don't want to talk about what kind of rain. If you grew up in the Pacific Northwest there, if you grew up in between Portland and Seattle, you know what I'm saying when I say it was raining. It wasn't a storm. It wasn't a downpour. It was the rain that you get in November in that area every single day.
Yeah.
It was just raining. So it wasn't a storm or anything, but we're still talking at night in the pitch black, in the rain, most likely into the woods. There are a bunch of clearings in the area. There are a bunch of rivers. But I'm going to say in the drop zone, 60% of it is heavily wooded.
If we're assuming that he survived the jump, and this is speculation because we don't know, but if the idea is that he survived, he hit the ground, we would have found his body by now if he hit the ground somehow and didn't survive or died shortly thereafter. So this really is, in essence, if he hits the ground, a true vanishing.
I would say so.
All right.
And he definitely hits the ground. So the idea that he plummets to his death somewhere there, and in this last 50 years, he hasn't been found.
Yeah.
I don't believe that.
Yeah.
People hunt those woods. People hike those woods. People work those woods. Even in the densest wooded places there, it's been traveled.
Yeah.
People would have noticed.
Yeah. Do we ever definitively resolve this?
I have no idea. I really have no idea. When I started this, I probably would have said at some point this will be solved. the more I learn, the more I am into it. I really have become discouraged on the idea that it'll be solved doing this show. Hmm. I had Arthur Friedberg on, who is like the most legit numismatist on the planet, which is, in case you didn't know, which I didn't, a person who is a combination historian on money and also a collector of money. His family literally wrote the book on U.S. paper currency. Mm. The book U.S. paper currency, which is renewed all the time, bears his last name. He knows everything about money. And I had, this was a great guest for me because this guy, he doesn't know anything about D.B. Cooper. Mm-hmm. He was aware of the money in the collector world because it was sold on auction.
Right.
And so I sent him an email, again, you know, just asking people. I asked this guy, hey, I'm looking for someone to come on my show to talk about D.B. Cooper's money. Someone who knows a lot about how currency works, how it flows, different things like that. Do you know anyone who could do that? Mm-hmm. And he responds right away, I could certainly do that, and I would love to be on your show.
Awesome.
And so he said, you know, I don't know anything about D.B. Cooper, so give me 2 weeks to learn something about that so I don't sound foolish on your show. And I was just like, you're the greatest, man. And he came on the show, and really some of the ideas that had been spouted and repeated and theorized over time, I mean, this guy just, he didn't even think about it for a second. He was like, oh, no, that's not true.
Yeah.
Eh, that wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
And I always fantasized that D.B. Cooper was spending his money and drinking pina coladas on the beach and you know, looking at the D.B. Cooper forum online and laughing.
Yeah.
But he was like, you know, that money goes back into circulation. The fact that none of those bills were ever flagged in a cash transaction, just, it seems incredibly unlikely to me. Mm-hmm. And that episode was like a wet blanket for me.
Yeah.
Doing it. He had all of the answers, but they were the answers I didn't want to hear.
Yeah. Earlier you talked about how this all began. Now I want to know how this all ends for you.
I have no idea. I interviewed Tom Kay, and he talked about the Cooper Vortex with me and said, you know, when I heard about this D.B. Cooper thing, I thought it would be something interesting for me to do for a few months, and I'd be out of it. That was 10 years prior to when I had talked to him about this.
Yeah.
And there is something about it where you can't escape. I only know one person who left the Cooper Vortex, and he had to do it in a harsh way.
Yeah.
Gentleman by the name of Sluggo. Left and never came back and really stuck to that. And I think that's the only way to leave. And
yeah,
I don't want to see myself leave that way. But at the same time, I've thought about quitting this show many times. Why am I doing this?
Yeah.
What am I doing this for? Why am I putting myself through this? At times, it really has become a job. And it's like, why am I doing this? I ask myself that all the time.
Yeah.
Is it true that you can't escape the Cooper Vortex? And where does this go? Where does this take me? I'm not going to get rich off this show. So what am I doing? How much time do I want to invest in this?
Yeah.
How much am I going to get out of it? I've gotten a lot out of it. I've learned a lot. I've made a lot of great friends.
Yeah.
And I am still passionate about D.B. Cooper. I do still want to talk to people about D.B. Cooper. But I'm quickly approaching. I thought I would have already exceeded the maximum D.B. Cooper that I could do. So maybe I'm saying I'm approaching the maximum when I'm going to be doing this for 25 years. Mm-hmm. And this is ridiculous for me to say.
Now we're getting warmed up. If you're following along, you've got a foundational understanding of the crime that was committed, the fallout of that crime, and the investigation that's opened up since then. When it comes to these kind of cold cases, it becomes apparent almost immediately that science is one of the heroes. Cases are solved almost every day using breakthroughs in science and modern-day DNA technology. If that's the case, what about Cooper? Can science succeed where history has failed? Only one man can answer that question. You know the drill. I send an email, we get the talking, and the guest that's been on the scientific tip of the spear for this case has arrived.
You know, everyone comes to this for different reasons, but you got involved in a very particular aspect of the case, and it's where you spent the majority of your time. Tell me how this all started for you.
Unusually, I got started in this case back in about 2007. I was not particularly interested in the Cooper case. I'd known about it as a young guy back in 71. But I was contacted by a fellow astronomer that knew about my work in astronomy and some other things. And as it turned out, he had been looking for the scientists to examine the money that was buried on Tina Bar and found in 1980. He had gone through several scientists, and I was the only guy that said yes. So I only thought it was going to be a few week project. It turned out 12 years later, 13 years later, whatever it is now, I'm still kind of on the case. So as the Cooper vortex is known to do, it sucked me in along with everyone else.
Tom Kay is a genius. No, really. This is the guy you want in a case like this. And he's been on it for a long time. Tom has made some of the most groundbreaking discoveries in the entirety of this investigation. And as you'll hear, he's still going. I have a feeling that if there's an answer out here, he's going to be involved in it.
So the reason why he called is because Special Agent Larry Carr had come on the case and he wanted to work on it, but the FBI said, no, we don't waste our time and efforts on, you know, case this old. He said, well, how about if we release information to the public and let them work on it? So his boss grudgingly kind of said yes. And as the internet does, you know, that's when the Cooper world came together to examine the new evidence. So that led to Larry Carr coming to the forum. They asked me if anybody examined the money, and then the search went out for the scientist, and I'm here today.
I mean, you know, on your site for Citizen Sleuth, you know, what I liked about it is there's a bunch of stuff on the site we'll reference tonight, but you mentioned that there's two goals when it comes to scientific analysis in a case with as many strings as this one. The first goal is to separate, you know, fact from fiction, right? And the second one is to determine if there's new information that hasn't been uncovered to that point. My question is, do you have to achieve the first goal before you can start on the second one, or can both of those be achieved concurrently?
Well, you usually have to get some more data to apply it to the current theories. Mm. So with Cooper, there is a lot of theories, like up the flight path and how the money ended up on Tina Bar, for instance. There was the Washougal washdown theory. There's the fact Cooper, there was a westerly flight path and the money fell directly on Tina Bar. There's the idea that Cooper landed on Tina Bar, buried the money and walked away. So there were a lot of things orbiting that particular question. So we needed some new data to apply to these theories and then determine whether the theories held water or not. So for instance, the Washougal washdown theory was fairly simple. We went to Google Earth, which wasn't available in 71, and we checked all the rivers to see if they went up into the Ariel Washington jump zone. Turns out they didn't, all right? Well, that's just one factor. The second thing we did was we went out to the Washougal River, which feeds into the Columbia River upstream from Tina Bar. And we put bundles of single dollar bills with a note attached wrapped in a rubber band, and we threw them into the river at various points along the river. Well, I gotta tell you, everybody laughed at us saying, well, you're just throwing your money away, because they were real dollar bills. It's about 20 of them in each bundle. We threw three bundles in there. A year later, we got one of the notes back. A kid had found the note about a couple of miles downstream from where we dumped the bundle, and there was no money, no rubber bands, just the card that had been encased in plastic. So from that data, you know, I mean, they were laughing, but we actually got data out of it. We know for a fact that money doesn't travel very far in the Washougal River, and certainly the rubber bands won't last long enough to hold on to everything and keep it bundled. So that's a case of getting new data, then applying it to the existing theories to see which ones hold water. And the Washougal washdown theory on multiple lines of evidence did not.
So, you know, and you've touched on it, I mean, a few times already. A lot of the work that you've done has revolved around the money, you know, where it ended up, how did it get there? How many of the answers in this case revolve around answering that question definitively?
There's two major questions in this case. You know, who Cooper was and what happened to him after he jumped is one of the big ones, and it's an ongoing mystery. But separate and almost as large a mystery is, what the heck was the money doing buried on Tina Bar?
Yeah.
That's a completely separate investigation, and there are no good answers for that. Even the answers that we've come up with have not narrowed the range of possibilities on how the money got there. And nobody's got a really good theory. I mean, all the theories are kind of patched together from, well, what if this and maybe that happened, but there's nothing that actually ties everything together in a nice package with the money. So the money is a continuing large mystery, and every rock we turn over with new evidence doesn't seem to help the case at all.
Yeah, you know, and I want to ask you about a more recent development. You know, let's talk about the diatoms. Just over a year ago, it was announced that the diatoms that you guys found on the small sample of bills that we do have were determined to be, as you quoted, a spring species, and they don't in fact bloom during the time in which Cooper would have jumped, which would have been in late November. What does that tell you about the potential drop zone and the money location, maybe?
Well, that the diatoms were a huge finding, because it's the real first piece of evidence that we can apply to the money in 50 years.
Yeah.
Anybody can read that paper. It was a peer-reviewed scientific paper. And I want to point that out. It was not just some speculation on my part. It went through the regular scientific channels, published in a scientific journal. It's available for download. If you just search Cooper diatoms, you'll find it. So first of all, for those of you who don't know, diatoms are a form of algae. Most algae is slimy, and when you walk across a rock on the bottom of a river, you can feel it. But diatoms are a particular group of algae where the single algae cell gets encased in a glass shell. So it basically lives in a glass house that's microscopic, about the size of a blood cell. And each species of algae produces its own shape. And there are thousands of crazy shapes, from stars to triangles to circles, everything you can possibly imagine. And each one is its own species. Now, the Columbia River, where the money was found, happens to be very well studied. And we know there's over a dozen species of diatoms in the Columbia River, and they've sampled them every month. So we know which ones bloom when, and there's a winter group, and then there's a spring and summer group. Well, one of the diatoms that we found on the money was Astrianella formosa, which is a star-shaped, rather large diatom that floats in the water. It does not end up in the sand on the bottom. It's planktonic is what we call it, and it floats. So we know from finding that species of diatom on the money, number one, the Cooper money got wet. It was in the Columbia River. Number two, it had to be in the Columbia River long enough for the bundle of money to fan out and for the diatoms to penetrate into the money, and then it got washed up on shore and was buried. We know from experiments that we did that you cannot get diatoms this large through the sand and into the money once the money's buried. We did some experiments. You can read about it in the paper. We also know that we didn't find any winter diatoms on the money. So that means the money could have only gotten wet in the spring. So the idea that Cooper fell out of the plane and the money landed in the river and was washing around in the river and then got buried sometime after the spring is a non-starter. We have a very limited time frame for the money to be wet, and then it got buried. We don't know what year that happened, but we do know that that's a scenario. So that wipes out all the ideas that Cooper fell in the water or Cooper landed and walked down the beach and then buried the money, because the money had to get wet. So it's not like somebody had a dry packets of money and buried them in the sand. The money was wet before it got buried.
The other aspect of your work in this case revolves around Cooper's tie. And to me, it's remarkable that that exists and we have it, you know, for continuing research. How did you get to work with the tie? What does having something like that do for a case like this?
Well, initially, when we were first approached by the FBI about doing the money, they brought the money to us. And it's very unusual for the FBI to allow, you know, private citizens to get involved in their case, and especially to give out evidence. So they brought the money down. We did a very good job analyzing the money, and they kind of realized that we were a serious group. So they allowed us to come to the archive and see all the evidence that was in the archive in Seattle. And we actually spent 3 days in the archive looking at everything. The things we knew we were going to see was the tie. And we had realized that I have an electron microscope, which is a very powerful version of a microscope. And the FBI didn't have that in 1971. So we knew that if we took particles off the tie, we could examine those particles to determine where they came from, which is kind of a standard procedure today. It was certainly not something they did back in 71. So we took samples and we were thinking about looking for pollen. That was our target was pollen. And we ended up finding pollen on the tie, but it turned out it wasn't the type of pollen. It was actually a spore, not a pollen. That's a long story. And they were used in pill separation. They would powder pills so the pills didn't stick together. So unfortunately, we couldn't place them in any part of the country. Like if it was cactus, you'd probably been from the Southwest. It was pine trees, it would have been from the northern tier. But it did tell us maybe he took a lot of pills on a daily basis. So that's what launched the initial investigation of the tie. We ended up looking at about 700 particles, which is a lot to do manually because it takes several minutes to find, evaluate, write down the data for each particle. After that, we got some other professionals involved after the fact. Mostly it was based on Josh Gates's investigation, wanting to look into it further. He got a very famous company, Macrone Labs, to do an automated analysis of the particles on the tie. And they analyzed over 100,000 particles. And that's when we found the really interesting stuff, like the rare earth elements, which combined with the titanium metal that we found in the tie, puts Cooper in a very, very small world. So that's what our contribution has been, is that we now have a profile of Cooper. We know kind of what he looks like, his height, his weight. We know he wore a suit, and we know that the tie went with him many places. And the tie is the only article of clothing that you don't wash. So it accumulated particles from everywhere he went, and it was fortunate that we were able to analyze. So unless you can come up with a Cooper suspect that can come up with titanium on his tie and rare earth elements on his tie, and he worked in a managerial or an executive position or an engineering position in a company where he'd wear a tie on a daily basis, that's not your suspect's a non-starter in our book.
Piggybacking off of what you just talked about, I mean, you discussed using scientific analyzation to help sort of eliminate suspects and theories. You just touched on that. It's not like the Earhart case that we've worked for so long and what's going on there. The ultimate answer, I think, is going to lie in taking sort of small but significant steps until you can safely and more definitively say, this is what happened, we think. In a case like this one, as big as this one, is that how it's going to get solved? Do you think it's going to get solved in the same manner? Do you think it's small, sort of smaller steps to kind of get to an ultimate ending? Or is there maybe an aha bombshell piece of evidence still out there somewhere, maybe?
Well, if I had to vote on those two, I would go for the bombshell evidence, actually.
Okay.
And there's this very specific reason for that. Cooper couldn't have possibly pulled this off in a vacuum. Somebody somewhere knows something about the Cooper case. And as long as Cooper was alive, they probably would not say anything because they probably was friend, relative, whatever. They would probably not say anything for fear that Cooper would get arrested and thrown in jail, right?
Yeah.
So for the 20 or 30 years after the case, he would have certainly been alive. At this point, it's probably better. He's probably better chance that he's dead than alive at this point, but he still could be hanging on somewhere out there. Once he is gone, which now is the zone we're in, somebody could come forward with some information and really crack things open. And I think that's how it'll happen. Now, in talking to the FBI over the years, they told me that even if you solve the case, we're not going to prosecute the guy. He goes, we don't drag 80-year-old guys into court. So I told him, I said, well, then why don't you put out a thing saying that if anybody comes forward with information, we'll give you immunity. And the case agent thought that was a great idea. And he went to his boss and his boss nixed it. So if we can get a change of heart at the FBI and they can say anybody with information come forward, we could maybe get some real progress on the case. But unfortunately, the FBI has been so bothered by this case, lawsuits and things, people threatening lawsuits for not investigating their suspect, that the FBI really wants to wash their hands of it.
What is keeping you so involved in this? Is it a purely a scientific thing? Is it, you know, why are you still doing this 12, 13 years after you got involved?
Well, you know, this is actually the least interesting thing I do of all my science projects. It just happens to be the one that gets on TV and people are interested in.
Yeah.
So do I work on this on a daily basis? No. Do I work on it a few weeks out of the year? Yeah. Yeah, that's probably it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not watching the forums every day for the latest breaking news about Cooper or the latest suspect. I don't even know who the suspects are, right? If something comes up like the money, I was approached by a guy who bought one of the bills.
Yeah.
And he said, Tom, you know, I paid a lot of money for this bill, but I'm willing to let you take some chunks out of it to analyze. Well, that changed the complexion of the game there, right? I hadn't been doing anything for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And when he came forward with that and said, let's do this, I said, great. And that turned, that was like a 6-week project. right? But it turned up the diatoms and it made a significant contribution to the case. The other thing that it did there was it made a contribution to forensic science, because this is the first time that diatoms were used to determine a time of year for a forensic event.
Yeah.
That had never happened before using diatoms in the forensic world. So Cooper has made a nice little contribution in the forensic world at this point. So thanks, Cooper.
Yeah. I guess the last question is, for now, is you think we'll ever find the rest of the money?
I think it's probably gone and spent. You know, the big mistake they made was not having sequential serial numbers. Mm. The serial numbers were randomized because they thought it would be a real tricky thing to do, you know, to give the guy randomized serial numbers that they recorded on microfiche. But it turned out nobody could search for the serial numbers then. It was too hard. You had to go through the whole list every time you had a suspect 20. So I think that the money probably ended up in circulation probably a year or so after the event when nobody was looking anymore. And it got spent, it got worn out, and it got cycled through the system, and it's done and gone. Mm. So I think that's where it. Will somebody come up with a 20 and prove that their uncle was Cooper? Maybe, maybe. You know, but that's what it would take for someone to show up with a suspect and say, here's a $20 bill nobody's seen before.
Well, you never know.
Let's hope.
How you doing so far? You still with me? Good, because we're just getting started. As I said in the opening of this episode, D.B. Cooper is a ghost. He's become an enigma, a legend. At the end of all this, you tell me if he's nothing more than a common criminal who got lucky, or a criminal mastermind that beat the system. In part two of our series, we'll turn up the heat, and we'll talk with more experts, hear more stories, and uncover more information. All right. We'll also introduce you to the man that I believe is D.B. Cooper. Weather's really getting rough. Hold on to those parachutes. See you next time. This is Chris Williamson. Thank you for listening to this episode of Vanished. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/vanishedpod, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @vanishedpod. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to iTunes to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your co-hosts for Vanished are Jennifer Taylor and Chris Williamson. The show is produced by Vanessa Williamson, mastered by TJ Cunahan, and edited by me, Chris Williamson. The opinions on Vanished are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films, Inc. Chris Evan Films, Inc. is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Vanished is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films, Inc., and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films, Inc. All rights reserved. Vanished is a Chris Evan Films production, copyright 2021. All rights reserved. Yeah.
Yeah.